Well, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Yeah, you know, I love words. Do you like words? Anyone like words? I got some favorites. Want to hear my all-time favorite? Quintessential. Isn't that a great word? Quintessential. I mean, it means like supreme, the greatest. I got another one. Ready? Linoleum. Think about it. Linoleum. Well, no one uses, no one walks. It's an old kind of floor covering, but it just rolls out. The tongue just doesn't have to work. Say it. Try it. Linoleum. Oh, what a great word. I got another one that I really, really love. It's actually a phrase. Ready? Counterintuitive. Isn't that a good one? Counterintuitive. Oh, I love that. You know, counterintuitive means it's not what you'd expect. And at Rosh Hashanah time, there's something very counterintuitive about the day Rosh Hashanah begins. And it goes like this. Wouldn't it make sense if Rosh Hashanah, which has among its themes, you know, the creation of the world, wouldn't it make sense that Rosh Hashanah would begin on the traditional date of the beginning of creation, day one? Does that make sense? What's our favorite word? Counterintuitive. No, it's not that way. Actually, it's really very, very interesting that the first day, the traditional the traditional creation of the world is Elul 25, but it's 6 days later that Tishri 1, we begin Rosh Hashanah. And so we wonder, why would Rosh Hashanah happen 6 days later? Well, what happens on the sixth day of creation? Does anyone know offhand? What gets created? Mankind. That's right, Adam and Chava. That's right. And so it's very, very interesting. And so in the liturgy, Mehayom Tachilat Ma'asecha, this day is the beginning of your works. Speaking of Rosh Hashanah, even though we have earlier days of God's creation, the first 5 days of the week. And so mankind is created on the last day of his working, followed by Shabbat, of course. So we're last in the sense that we're created last, but we're first in terms of God's creative work because we represent the pinnacle of his creation. This is really a very, very important idea which has huge implications for us. So we're the first in terms of reflecting God's purposes for the world. We have this amazing role as the quintessential, how's that? His quintessential creation in this world. Now we acknowledge there are angels and there's lots of other life forms and everything. We get all that. But in terms of his larger purposes, it's with us. And let me just say parenthetically, just to bring it into, you know, our situation, it's why we are really opposed to this whole movement called transhumanism. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about? It's an attempt to really remake man, combining too much technology and other things to change man in terms of his relationship to the created order. And it's a long story, and I certainly don't want to get into it, but it does bug me that in contemporary culture, there is a real downplaying of the importance of mankind as his creation intended to fulfill his purposes in a way that no other creatures, no other people, no other aspects of his creation can accomplish. And so, one way to think about it is this way. We have the capacity, unlike any of the animals or any of the created elements that he made, we have the capacity to say yes or no to him. Human freedom, what a gift. A gift, but a huge responsibility. And to phrase it within the vision of Ruach Israel that the board has been working on is to say, we have the ability to say, Hineni, here I am. Isn't that true? We have the capacity to say, Hineni, or to say, no thanks, I'm really not interested. That is part of this amazing reality called humanity. We have the capacity to say yes or no to our Creator. He'll exert influence. His angels will exert influence. His Torah, his teaching, exerts influence. Good societies express influence. But at the end of the day, we say, yes, Hineni, or no, I'm really not interested. Okay, so I want to talk about moments of Hineni in our own congregation's experience. And I'd like to begin with a person that we've never met, but one day, I believe in Allah Baba, or in heaven, we will meet her. And her name was Mary Hyos. Have you heard that name before? Yeah, a number of you have. If you've been in book club, you know that her name has come up prominently in two of the books we read. And so the story is this. Mary Hyos lived in Budapest, Hungary. She was a Jewish woman who became a follower of Yeshua. Now, she would not have described herself as a Messianic Jew because the term really wasn't in vogue or wasn't even created yet. So she would have called herself a Jewish Christian. There weren't synagogues for her to go to. So, you know, you can imagine she loved Yeshua. She was glad to be Jewish, but the world that she was in was a little bit different than the world we occupy. But she became an English teacher. She would teach private lessons to students, and she would teach them English by having them read passages of the Bible. And guess what one of her favorites was? Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, right? And so she would teach them English, and she would say to them, who do you think this is, right? And there was a particular student that she had, and her name was Mary Ann Fisher. She studied with Mary Hyos as a teenager, really, but she wanted to learn English. And Mary Ann Fisher became a follower of Yeshua through Mary Hyos. And Mary Ann Fisher's, she married soon after that, and her husband George, he was from an Orthodox background, not real practicing, but nonetheless from an Orthodox family, and he became a follower of Yeshua. And they were in Hungary in 1943 when the Germans invaded, and the story is really great. How many of you from book club enjoyed learning the story of the Fishers? Fabulous, right? I mean, the hands, you should see them go up. Fabulous, really worth reading. I have the book with me, I can show it to you later. But what we want to stress is that they made it through, and in May 27th, 1946, they had a little boy whose name was John. And they traveled, eventually ending up in the United States and eventually in Philadelphia. And John grew up, and one day in 1971, August of 1971, better than a half a century ago now, I was on the beach in Ocean City. Why was I there? Well, because I spent that summer studying with my trombone teacher, and in exchange for two or three lessons every week, he would have me do the grunt work of rebuilding a cottage that to rent. He wanted to rent this college. So I had to dig, and you know, we put up sheetrock and this and that, and he would give me lessons. Well, one day, I'm sitting on the beach in Ocean City, and I'm there sitting on my little white towel, and these two guys come up to me out of nowhere. And one was a guy named Al Nuccheroni. I still remember his name, Al Nuccheroni, and John Fisher. Now John was a graduate student at University of Pennsylvania, and they came up to me, and to make a long story short, they gave me a survey, and they wanted to talk about religion. Fine, happy to give my opinion. And I found out this guy John was Jewish, and he believed in Yeshua. Whoa, never heard of that before. And again, to make a very long story short, 9 days later, I surrendered to Yeshua. Just John and I were sitting on the porch of a little hotel called the Lincoln Hotel, since long burned down, and we're sitting on the porch. It was a gorgeous day, not too unlike today. It was in August, but cool and breezy and fabulous, just like today. And I surrendered. And that was, you know. So here, Mary Hyos, you get the picture? Mary Hyos talks to his future mom, Miriam, and he grows up in a Messianic Jewish, quasi-Messianic Jewish home. And here he is with an evangelical group sharing about Yeshua, and then I come to Yeshua. Well, that was really, really cool. And so then 10 years later, in 1981, Sue and I came here. We left Chicago on August 12th, 1981, and we headed for Boston. Okay, now once we came to Boston, we ran into some people who many of you know about, and perhaps some of you met them, Tom and Jutta Gerendis. Familiar name? Yeah, right? Tom and Jutta. And he was a teenager, and Mary Hyos led Tom to become a follower of Yeshua. This was an amazing moment, and you know, this is Holocaust time, and it was scary, and it was tough, and Tom becomes a believer in Yeshua, Messianic Jew. He was going to make his bar mitzvah, and then the Nazis invaded, so he couldn't have his bar mitzvah. It was like days later it was supposed to be, and it never happened, right? So Tom makes it to Canada, and there he meets a cute girl, a German girl who had also emigrated to Canada, and Jutta's uncles were high-level Nazis. We're talking SS, okay? But she hated it. She didn't understand what they were all about as a young girl, but then as she grew a little older and learned, she just despised what they stood for in terms of their philosophy. And she and Tom get married in Canada, and they make their way to Boston, and they have three little girls. The youngest one was not that young, but 12 years old, and that was Rebecca. Is Rebecca here today? Hello, Rebecca. How you've grown! Rebecca was the young one. I remember your pigtails. I remember them. And then Maria, the middle sister, and then, of course, Esther. Our Esther here, right? And Esther was a late teenager at the time, as I recall. And here, Mary Hyos has an effect on Ruach that involves not only, you know, the effect on us through John, but also we have Rebecca's family. Now, Tom and Jutta never became members of Ruach. They were very much ensconced in their community. We never made any issue of that, of course. But they loved us, and we loved them. And they were an amazing couple. So what are we talking about? We're talking about great moments of Hineni. You see, Mary had to decide to share Isaiah 53. You see what I mean? Did she have any idea at the time of the ramifications and outworking of what would happen? No way. Not at the time. Let me give you a couple more examples. Let's move on. I want to talk about David Nardoni. Dave Nardoni passed away very recently, and he had advanced cancer, and it finally took his life. I'm telling you, he's having the time of his life right now. He loves to study. He likes to do creative card making. He is having, and the Hebrew classes up there, I hear, forget it. They're really great, you know what I mean? Well, Dave came to us around 1981, 82, Elizabeth also. And Elizabeth was going to be here today, but I don't think she made it, unfortunately. Well, anyhow, Dave says Hineni I'll teach David Hebrew. David, my David, our David. Boy, is he good at Hebrew. It all started with Dave Nardoni, with the five-year-old David Nickel, and he taught him the alphabet, and look at him now. You know, he's like fluent, all right? So, you see, another hineni moment. Dave said yes. I want to share some more with you. I want to tell you a little bit about this guy, Gary Halzell. You've heard the name before, right? Gary Halzell, there he is. Oh, Gary, hi. And I want to tell you the story. Do you like this sanctuary, our building and everything? Do you like it? It's really quite beautiful, isn't it? It won an architectural award when it was built for the use of space, and that was very nice. And it's been a magnificent structure, wonderful, has met our needs wonderfully. You got the offices upstairs, the education wing downstairs. You have a beautiful sanctuary with this. We demanded high ceilings to suggest the loftiness and grandeur of God. Of course, more recently, this is a beautiful ark. Here's the story. Ruach started as a little teeny marginalized group at a hotel in Boston called the Travel Lodge. It's not that anymore. 1200 Beacon Street. And it was a hot room. It had pillars in the way. You had to look around. And it had carpeted walls. And I just remember, like, the sound. We had an old electric piano, and the notes would fall on the floor because of the acoustics were intentionally bad. I don't know why that was, but it was intentional. And we moved from there. I'll tell you quickly the story of the moving. We met on Friday nights, and the bar was right next door. And by the way, this hotel was known for had a kind of a bad reputation. You get my drift about that, you know. A place for liaisons that weren't the most holy. Okay. So anyway, but they had a bar next door and a thin wall between our meeting room and the bar. And it was an evening service, and we would celebrate Hazikaron like we do now, not as full orbed as the way we do it. And I remember we didn't even have a kiddush cup. We had little cups and only. And all of a sudden, the band kicked in, and they were good. And they were doing Van Morrison's Moon Dance. Ba-da-dee-ba-doo-da-doo-da-ba-da-ba. And I'm like this. Right? And I knew we had to move, which we did, to another hotel, to Howard Johnson's. And along the way, while we met at the Howard Johnson's, and I remember thinking, you know, we never knew what room we were going to be at Howard Johnson's. Would it be the Fells room or the mezzanine or that hot, sticky room on the seventh floor? You remember it, Gary? And you never knew. And they had a marquee, which, like a bulletin, which would tell you where you would be. And I remember, it's a memory from way back, and on it would be Amway, this room, Amway products. Silver Mind Control, that way. Ruach Israel, wherever we were. And I remember thinking and saying to Sue, you know, here we are with this sense of ourselves as doing something really important for the kingdom of God, and yet we don't get top billing, Silver Mind Control, Amway, you know, and there we were, and it was just ironic. But I met a pastor who had a small church in Islington, a small town near here, and we became friends, and we began dreaming about the possibility of having a joint facility, because we would need it Friday night, Saturday, they would need it Sunday. This is Pastor Art McPhee. And all of a sudden, one night, as we're thinking about this and looking around, we checked a couple of properties. We didn't have any money. Anyhow, it's Friday night, right after Shabbat dinner. We're living in the house, 486 Baker Street. You may remember that house, Gary. And all of a sudden, I got a call from Pastor Art, and the essence was land ho, meaning there was a piece of property in Needham, Massachusetts, 1.78 acres, 1.78 acres, And the phone started to shake in my hand. I mean, I was like nervous. But this is making it real. And we didn't have any money or anything. And I needed to go to the congregation at that time, obviously, and ask, is this something you want to pursue? Land has become available. And shall we pursue this? And I asked. And you sense the ambivalence in the room. Do you know what I'm saying? Because people didn't know. I mean, the costs and this, all those things, you know, cross your mind about, is this something we can do? This guy, Gary Halzel, stands up and says, and I quote, and you'll correct me if I don't get the words exactly right, "We got to do this. If I have to, I'll put the boulders on my back and carry them." Yeah, you know. Right. See, he was there. He's the guy. It changed the room. And everyone with one voice said, yeah, this is something we got to do. We put a bid, $201,000 on the land. We beat out a few people who we'd expected would have wanted it, including a news anchor of one of the major stations in Needham. And we got the land. And what began was a journey of fundraising. And I won't take the time to get into all that. But you see, Gary, you said Hineni. And we, and I hope you'll thank him later. No, let's do it now. 1, 2, 3. Thank you, Gary. We would be in, the Marquis of Silver Mind Control would still be over us in the Fells room. Ugh. And instead, here we are. Now, obviously, there was more to the equation than that. A lot of people helped, and there was all kinds of things. But it really did begin that night. It was a Hineni moment. I want to share one more with you. This goes back to David Nardoni. It was a very important moment. You see, our theology has matured over the years because Messianic Judaism has matured. There were things as a baby movement we had no time to think about, and nor did we have the theological expertise and the scholarship to be able to deal with. How do you put together a movement which claims roots in the Jewish world, even though we haven't been part of that world for, call it, 1,400 years, and is connected to the larger body of Messiah, which exists irrespective of culture or national or language backgrounds? How do you claim with integrity that you're part of the Jewish people and yet part of this larger community? And we've been working on that at this intersection between two historically antagonist communities, and we think we've really got something to show for it. But along the way, there were certain decisions that the scholars among us saw, and I'm not a scholar, but I was part of that world, that milieu of people coming up with things, and we had to figure out a way that both the equality of Jew and Gentile in the Messiah would interface meaningfully with that there is a distinct calling of Jews as Jews, and if that's lost, and we do what the church has done, which has said, well, you know, the true Israel is all the believers. Well, if everyone's Israel, and if everyone's Jewish, then no one is. It's like, you get that. And so we had to find a way, and that's worked our way into our liturgical expression. There are some things, and they're not many, that, you know, is just reserved for Jews to do. And one of them, of course, is the wearing of the tallit. But I'm talking about 20 years ago. And it's not the tallit. It's the fringes representing the 613 mitzvot. Okay? And that is uniquely enjoined on Israel. And the Apostle Paul is absolutely clear that Gentiles should not feel compelled to be under that covenant. We all together, as Jews and Gentiles, through Messiah, have entered into the renewed or new covenant. Okay, again, I want to be expeditious here. Now, here's the moment that was very, very important. At that time, Dave Nardoni was our cantor. He had a lovely voice, and he was a very dedicated guy. And we had seven male elders, again, and in retrospect, it's much better to have a board like we have now, where you have female energy and male energy. It's vastly superior. But nonetheless, I said to the guys, I said, listen, pastorally, it would be improper for me to take something away from you which has been conferred. And so I'm not making any demands here. But really, theologically, it's appropriate for Jews to be wearing the tallit and not non-Jews. But I said I wasn't making a demand here because you can't do that. You can't confer something and then take it away. It's not humane. It's not kind. And it's not right. But here's the moment I wanted to tell you about. Dave Nardoni came up to me not long after that. I don't remember the time frame. It could have been a week, two, three. I don't remember. And he said to me, he said, Rabbi Rich, you know, I've been thinking about it. The baby is growing up. And what he meant by that is Messianic Judaism, Ruach Israel. The baby is growing up. And I just want to say that I agree, I do not want to wear my tallit anymore. And I said, Dave, thank you so much, because it was such a powerful, powerful symbolic gesture. And the net result is that it's been fine. You know, it's been fine as we've gone along. I think some people may not understand completely initially, but it makes so much sense, because you have to have both boundaries and embrace. And I think at Ruach we do well with that. But this was one of those hineni moments that was very, very important. I want to share one more with you. And this is an intensely personal one. Every year of Congregation Ruach Israel's existence as a legal entity, a 501c tax-exempt body, we always have a congregational meeting where the congregation has to decide on important issues, like the budget, that's the major thing. And we had our meeting, and it was led by a couple of the leaders. And they, two of them came up to upstairs after the meeting, where I was sitting in the office at the time, and they said, here are our letters of resignation. We're gone. We're leaving. And the reasons, you know, I don't even want to speak about the reasons. I think that it had to do with, again, this kind of shift from what we would call the Hebrew Christian or over-universalized Messianic Judaism, where everyone's wearing tallits and everyone's doing everything, and no serious Jew can take a Messianic Jewish movement like that seriously, because you're erasing all the boundaries, and that would not be helpful. And so Sue and I are both upstairs, and younger leaders, yeah, I'm tougher now, but back then, you know, that kind of thing is, well, it would have been devastating any time, because it feels like a sucker punch. I had no idea that they were upset or anything. It was just really weird. And they handed their letters, and Sue and I are sitting there, and we're so sad and upset. It wasn't a matter of, like, look, we're thinking of doing something. Can we talk about this? Can we negotiate this? It wasn't that. It was just that unequivocal, and here's what's going to happen. We're leaving. We're out. And here's the hineni moment. Do you ever have an experience where you felt like you were led by the Spirit in a profound way? I think many of you have. It's an intuitive sense that goes very deep. Well, apparently, Dave and Elizabeth Nardoni, who were traveling home, I believe they lived in Mansfield. Where do they live? Mansfield, I think, at the time. And they said, no, we've got to go back. They weren't sure why. They just knew that they had to be with us, with me and Sue. And they came upstairs and said, are you guys okay? And we said, well, really, we're not. Here's what happened. Now, it isn't as if they had any, no one had any intimations that this whole thing was going to go down. I'm quite sure of that. They didn't know at all. But there's that voice of the Spirit. And it was one of those hineni moments that, I've never told this story publicly before. I don't think even Rabbi Nathan, I'm not sure I even mentioned it to you. But the point I'm making is that they listened to the voice, and the comfort that they offered us was very, very helpful at that moment, as you can understand. And so, what are we trying to say here as we wrap up? On these holy days, we say, Hineni, here I am, God, at these long services, right, to give thanks to you for being our Creator and our King. Hineni, here we are at services coming this week to intercede for our people Israel. Hineni, here we are to ask for forgiveness for each of our short-sightedness and self-absorption. Hineni, here we are, O God, to commit ourselves to being better congregants, better friends, better husbands, better wives, better sons, better daughters, better followers of Messiah Yeshua this coming year. So I want to encourage us all, in light of the examples and the far-reaching impact of Hineni that is 80 years and counting in terms of our own congregation and Mary Hyos and what she did, in light of all these things, I just want to encourage us all to understand you never know the implications, the good that will issue from your Hinenis offered to God this year. Okay? So, let's say Hineni. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Hineni. How about again? Hineni. One more. Hineni. Shabbat Shalom. Everybody.
And the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.